All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 75 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. The topic today is Reconstruction. The question that we are going to try to answer here is, how do you put a country back together again after a civil war over slavery? And this is, again, kind of a question that seems like it's about the past. And the Reconstruction era goes from 1865, when the war ends, to 1877, as we shall see. It's a 12-year period, quite a long time ago, and it seems like it's about the past. But it's not. If it's an important part of history, it has some essential connection to life as we know it around us, and it most certainly does. Because American culture is still, and I don't know how long it would ever will continue to do so, I suspect it will not in our lifetimes fully recover from the Civil War. American culture is still affected by the Civil War and the institution of slavery and the resolution to the issue that was enacted during Reconstruction. America still hasn't recovered from it. There were many positive things that happened in this period that we're going to study, but also a lot of negative things. And ultimately, America did not recover fully. And so it's something to think about. And it's a connection that you can try to make as you are, and I would encourage you to make as you are thinking about history. If you look around you today, you can still see that there are fault lines, you could call them, in American society. I would say there still is a fault line between North and South. I would say that there still is a lingering effect or after effect of the Civil War in terms of the relationship between people from the North and the South. And I would say that, of course, recognizable still issues in terms of race relations in the United States. I think it was a very important symbolic moment for the United States when Barack Obama was elected president. And so that was kind of, I think, one of those moments that showed that how far America had come in a positive sense. But it's interesting to know just how much Americans are still really conflicted and have a lot of trouble with the question of racism. It has not gone away as a social issue. In fact, in some senses, it has gotten worse. And so that remains a serious problem. There isn't any slavery. But slavery is just an overt, obvious injustice in a society that's kind of, in a sense, easy to deal with. But other types of problems in society having to do with racism are not. They're more subtle and they're more insidious, and America still suffers from them. So that's definitely a part of what's present-centric about this topic. So, sadly, it's something that we continue to have to deal with in American society. So, anyway, let's go see what happened in this period. What was accomplished? Some positive things were accomplished. But also what some of the lingering issues were after it was all said and done. So, As far as putting the country back together again, trying to imagine, because it requires an act of historical imagination, and we can help with the help of an artist. Sometimes we can do that. So I happen to like this particular painting. We're not going to do it in history through art. We could. I mean, it's not. It's verging on a great painting. It's a strange artist who painted this, this painting kind of captures the moment at the end of the war. You have on the right-hand side, you have this Union officer with the sword kind of dangling off of his belt there, right? And in his high boots and everything. And you have a Union soldier who's standing on guard with his rifle in the dark blue uniform there. And next to them are these three Confederates, and you can see they've laid down their weapons, and they're sitting there, prisoners, and they're kind of just looking at each other. They're taking each other in because they used to be at war with each other, and but now it's over, and they're prisoners, and well. What now? That's kind of the question of Reconstruction. What now? How do you put a society back together again that has all of these wounds, that has all of this history now of violence and all of the death and destruction that's been wrought upon it by the people of the country against each other? Well, how do you put a country back together again? So, I mean, it's hard enough because on the one hand, you've got railroads and homes and businesses and everything that have been literally physically destroyed. Entire cities in some cases that have been burned to the ground. So that's absolutely devastating. That's just a matter of a lot of physical effort that's going to have to be put into putting those back together again. And on the other hand, you've got kind of the emotional toll, because 600,000 people died in the Civil War. So it's a staggering number. And of course, a lot of men, a lot of fathers, but also women and children in different cases dying of starvation or destitute and so on. And 600,000 people dead. How many people were in America at that point? Alexander, I'll let you Google it on behalf of the class and we'll wait for the answer. Just Google how many people in America during the Civil War? Tell us. So anyway, that doesn't, no matter what it was, I'm going to guess somewhere on the order of 50 million people. No matter what it was still an enormous loss. And so people had to recover, right? These were wounds. Imagine just what it would have been like with your families destroyed. Your life completely upended. And then, well, just on a practical level now, the question was, well, these people who have now been at war with each other for so long, how do we return to having a society in which we all function together? So it's kind of an interesting problem to contend with, just to think about what it would be like to have to do this. And I think one way to make it understandable and to kind of scale it down a little bit and make it more understandable is to think about what it's like in society. And you might not, of course, still have any personal identification with this issue, but it's probably less abstract, so easier for you to understand. What's it like to receive a criminal back into society? What's it like to receive a convicted criminal back into society? So let's just take as an example. Imagine somebody who who is a convicted thief who stole, I don't know, broke into people's houses in the community and stole money from them. Stole things and was eventually captured by the police and then convicted of theft and imprisoned for 5 or 10 years for all of the crimes committed. And then at the end of that term, that person is released from prison. Now what? Think about the weight of that past, right? On that person, for that particular individual, and for the community that he was once a part of and perhaps is returning to. What's that like? How do you reconstruct? Because assuming that you do, right? Because, I mean, some criminals just become hardened career criminals and they basically return to crime and end up back in prison. And before you know it, I mean, they're just spending pretty much their lives in prison. That happens. But on the other hand, assuming you want to, assuming you're hopeful and you want to return to life, how does that happen? What does that situation look like for a person who's a convicted criminal and for the society that's receiving that person back? How does it work? How do they get back in? For starters, you know, do you just snap your fingers? Do they just... You're released from prison and therefore you're just like everybody else? So, Bria, share your thoughts, please.
You just start over and you just don't have any trust in that jar and hopefully you get a job or something and start to prove yourself again.
Okay, so for you as an individual, you have to take actions necessary to kind of rebuild your life, right? So rebuild, reconstruct. This is a reconstruction on a personal level. All right, so you have to commit to making that change. We'll come back to that point, right? Your personal commitment to making the change. I mean, part of what makes a hardened criminal is that refusal to do that, right? So if you go to prison for crimes you've committed and you don't find a way to rehabilitate yourself, and understand why you were imprisoned and understand that the crimes you committed justify your imprisonment and that you'll have to live in a different way when you get out. If you can't make those, if you can't do that, then you'll end up being a criminal again, right? So that's going to be kind of an issue here with the South and the states of the South and rejoining the Union and the people of the South rejoining the Union, not being willing to face, not accepting the meaning of what has happened, not being willing to change and to make a different kind of life, to rebuild their lives. That's going to be definitely a big part of it. But what about the society now? We looked at it, Bria looked at it from the angle of the person, which is very valid and important because there's kind of two sides to it, right? From the angle of the person involved, they've got to rebuild their lives. They've got to reintegrate themselves into the society. But what about the society? What does it do? It has a role to play, right? What happens when a criminal is reintroduced into society? What does the society have to do? Alexander says, accept him? Is that it, Alexander? There's two words? What else? Alexander says, I can't talk right now. Well, Bria has thoughts. I want to put some other folks on the line here. Declan, what about you? What does society have to do?
Not sure.
Nothing? Just kind of, okay, you're free. Go ahead. Do whatever you want.
No, I said I'm not sure.
I know that. I'm asking. I'm trying to probe here. I'm trying to get you to actually try to come up with an answer rather than just say I'm not sure. I mean, is there something that needs to be done or nothing?
Something.
Okay. I mean, like the government, for instance, which put this man in prison and is releasing him. Doesn't the government have a certain obligation to the people of the community?
To ask them
for permission to act in a certain way?
To see what they think about their actions.
Okay. All right. So to inform the community, I think this is part of the general interaction between the people and the government. That's fine. But the government has a basic function, which is to protect people's rights. So Declan, if they're releasing a criminal into society, a convicted criminal, and they're saying, we're going to put you back in society, doesn't the government have an obligation or a responsibility there?
To tell the population that they're doing that.
Okay. It should be official, right? It can't be kind of sly and sneaky, but at the same time, I mean, what is the main thing that they're supposed to be doing? Continuing to protect people's rights. So what else do they do? What do they do with criminals when they release them? To make sure that happens.
Brand.
Oh my gosh. You don't mean physically, but you mean kind of tracking or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you're on the right track. Alexander can't speak, but he says parole. Bria, go ahead.
What I was going to say is they make him promise, what I think is they would make him promise to, for a certain period of time, you can't do this or this or this, mm-hmm. And if you do, you're going to go back.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. There's a period, there's a kind of probationary period. You're on parole, as they say. And that's a French word that means you give your word. And you have to report to the government and report on your activities. And they're going to track you and pay attention to how you are acting as you return to society. And so that's part of the government's responsibility in letting a person back into the society after they're a convicted criminal. They owe it to the people not to be releasing people who are going to recommit crimes. So they have to track these people and make sure that they are reintegrating. So that's kind of, on a personal scale, that's what it looks like. I want you to kind of think of that. The reason why I wanted to discuss that and bring that up is, think about what it would be like now in this reconstruction scenario where the federal government has to let whole states back into the country. Right? Entire societies in Alabama, Mississippi, Virginia, South Carolina, these entire organized societies with their state governments have seceded, which is to say they rejected the laws of the United States and have rebelled. And they have fought a war and committed mass murder on the battlefield. And so, well, oh my gosh, what do we do with that? How do you bring that back in to your society? That's a big problem. That's a really big question. And part of it has to do with, right, remember what Breer was saying about the individual having to kind of rehabilitate themselves. Well, what about on the state level? What would it have been like at this juncture for the states to be brought back into the union? What was it? What was on their side of the equation? What did they have to do to get back in, to reconstruct the United States? Or what would they have had to do? Because as we're going to see, they refused to do it. So reconstruction was quite an involuntary thing. But try to transfer this context. A criminal would have to personally commit to not being a criminal anymore. What would Southerners have to do on a cultural level, really? To return to the United States, what would they have to do? What does that look like? what they have to do in terms of their own selves. So they're not going to be repeat offenders like our criminal. You're going to have to change who you are, Bria.
You're really going to have to want to change.
Yeah, very good, right? That's the beginning. You're going to have to want, you're going to have to commit to being different. You might not even want to, but you're going to have to. Otherwise, right? I mean, otherwise, where do you end up? What's your situation if you refuse to? Well, we're actually going to see that. Reconstruction lasted 12 years. The war lasted 4 years. Reconstruction lasted three times that long because the Southerners refused to do it. They refused to change. And there was a lingering, long-standing cultural conflict over the meaning of the Civil War and over the culture in the South refusing to change. So it was hard to do. And then that, you know, there was basically a permanent scar. Not only because of the war, but because of this cultural refusal to change. So there's that. Now, on the other hand, again, swapping contexts here, right? In the context of an individual, the government has got to make sure that it's protecting society from this potential criminal or convicted criminal who's now reintegrating into society. So the government's got to watch out for this person and make sure that they're not going to commit new crimes. So who can make the leap now into the Reconstruction context? What did the federal government have to do now in this bigger picture with these states having been conquered militarily, being brought back into the Union? What did it have to do? What would, in effect, what would parole look like for a state is my question. What would parole look like for a state? Right? You lost the Civil War. Hundreds of thousands dead. So you've had your punishment and you've been imprisoned and you've been disarmed and you go home. Okay, but now you're on parole. You're an entire state on parole. What does that look like? Well, if you were a part of the North now, what would you want to see? If it was your job as the government to make this happen, what would you insist on seeing? What would be your rules for your parolees? You wouldn't have any? Alexander?
You make sure that they don't have slavery and that they don't, like, keep sort of accepting it, even though it's illegal now.
Okay, I mean, this is the fundamental, right? I mean, this is the big cultural divide, slavery. So that's got to be resolved. And the thing is, it wasn't resolved yet. So if you're going to rebuild the country, you need to resolve that one. Because this thing, which we saw yesterday, the Emancipation Proclamation, didn't do it. It was not enough. Right? So when Abraham Lincoln issues this proclamation, and it says here, all persons held as slaves in these rebellious parts of the United States shall be free. Well, okay, that's fantastic, but what does it not say? Think about this. All the people that are slaves shall be free. That's the proclamation in these particular parts of the country. So what does it not say? What about slavery as such? Alexander.
Well, first of all, it doesn't say that the rest of the country, all those slaves are still there. And second of all, it doesn't say anything about not making new slaves.
There you go. Exactly. Two crucial points. The Emancipation Proclamation did not render slavery as such illegal. It said that the slaves in those areas that were rebellious at the time, which, you know, if you look at the details of it, for instance, in Louisiana, the parish of St. Bernard was not in rebellion. So anybody that was a slave there is not free. So, and the county of Berkeley inside of Virginia was not in rebellion at the time. So the slaves there are not free, and so on. So that's part one that Alexander's got, which is there were parts of the United States where slaves were not free. I mean, in particular, right, if we look at, let me bring this up. If we go back to my map here, for instance, everything that's dark blue here, Missouri, Kentucky, West Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, these were five states that had slavery, which still did, in which the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply because those states were not in rebellion. They were a part of the Union. So you got slavery there. You have slavery in the various parts of the southern states that had already been captured by 1863. So it stays there. And you don't have a law that says slavery is illegal. So you still have the possibility, and this is the frightening and perverse thought, you still have the possibility, after a civil war with 600,000 dead, of the rebirth of slavery. Unless you're going to reconstruct the way that the government works. Something's got to be done. The government was broken. The federal government was broken. The state governments were broken. These were American governments that either explicitly or implicitly accepted slavery. The state governments had official slavery. The Constitution implicitly accepted slavery. So these are broken documents. These are broken governments. They need to be fixed. If they're not going to be fixed, it doesn't matter if these states come back in. You don't have a country that's been reconstructed. It's put back together again, but it's still broken. So, Abraham Lincoln recognized this as the war was coming to a close. Sadly, he could not oversee the process of Reconstruction. I think that if he had been around, which is quite tragic, if he had been around, I think Reconstruction would have gone better. I think he was quite a great leader, and I think he would have succeeded in doing certain things that later leaders were not capable of doing. He was assassinated, as some of you probably know. And so if you're going to read about Lincoln, which is a worthy thing to do, if you're going to go to the public library, maybe get a biography or something on somebody, he would be a good choice. You'll read that he was killed, assassinated by a Southerner. And so he could not lead the country at this point. But he had proposed the idea that it was time to close this chapter once and for all. He wanted, now there were two ways to do that, which have to do with this concept of kind of reintegrating the country. There were two ways to do it. One was get the states to do it. And that's what Lincoln wanted first. So, as well as issuing the Proclamation of Emancipation, he issued the Proclamation of Reconstruction. And later that year, 1863, And what it said was, we're going to let you back in the union if you do a few things. Number one, 10% of your population has to swear an oath to the Constitution before federal officials. So we have your electoral rolls, we have your census, we know how many people there are in the state. We'll call it 10%. 10% of the people need to show up and swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States. Once that's happened and we've gathered together the statistics, then you can form a new state government. Anybody that was a Confederate leader during the war is off limits. You cannot put them back in government. But anybody else can be elected. You can create a new government. And then, if you want back in the Union, you have to abolish slavery within your state. So this is like a government putting a person on parole, right? Putting a criminal on parole. You must do X, Y, and Z. You can't return to society like everybody else because you're not like everybody else. You have a criminal record, or because you're a state, you have a record of rebellion. So if you want to prove that you want to rejoin the Union, enough of your people have to swear an oath to the Constitution. You have to form a new government, and as the most crucial symbolic act of your rejoining the Union, you have to pass state laws abolishing slavery. So that was Lincoln's original plan for Reconstruction, and hoping basically that the states would take the initiative and do this and rejoin the Union, but they didn't. So what we end up having early in the Reconstruction era in 1865 is this case of kind of like a criminal who's been released, but who intends to return to a life of crime. So now what do? Right? I mean, this is a much bigger problem, right? But it's essentially the same type of problem. What do? Since the states are refusing to abolish slavery themselves, well, now what was possible? What could be done? What was the other option? Everybody here should know that one. So the states refused to do it. What was the only way that the federal government could get rid of slavery? Piper, what was it called when you changed the Constitution? What's it called to make a change to the Constitution? It's a word that means addition.
Oh, it's at the tip of my tongue.
The Bill of Rights has 10 of them. Crucial, crucial vocabulary word. Juliet?
Amendment.
Amendment. All right, so how do you do it? How do you get an amendment to the Constitution? This was our whole big problem in those 1800s, in this period leading up to the Civil War. How do you do it, Alexander?
You need a supermajority.
Okay. Now, this is the interesting part. You're right, you need a supermajority of two-thirds. Now, in a way, this is the irony of the states refusing. You know, yesterday we were talking about the irony of the Civil War. Here's another one. The southern states were refusing to abolish slavery. So the irony was, by doing that, they were refusing to rejoin the Union as accredited members of the American government. And so what did that permit? Take all these pink states out of the equation, and what do you have now, Timothy?
You can have a supermajority to officially abolish slavery.
Exactly. Now, even then, it wasn't easy, because not everybody in the country was an abolitionist. Not everybody in the country was morally courageous. So, back at that point in history, the Democratic Party was pro-slavery. And so there were people in the North that that didn't want to do it, that didn't want to abolish slavery, astounding as it might sound. So it took a while. It took a pretty difficult struggle to get the amendment, but it did finally come about. So we have in 1865, we have the first of the Reconstruction Amendments to the Constitution, the 13th Amendment. So we had the Bill of Rights, which were the first 10 amendments, and then there were two more kind of minor amendments that had happened since the founding. So not a lot of changes, kind of interesting. Only two small amendments all the way until 1865. So evidently the Constitution had functioned quite successfully, other than the issue of slavery, of course. So now we get the 13th Amendment, and, well, it finally laid it out once and for all. No slavery shall exist within the United States, in essence. Right? So the official abolition of slavery was finally achieved through the 13th Amendment. The problem was that the southern states didn't like it and didn't want it. And what they were going to do was they were going to replace official state-based slavery with unofficial and community-based and private slavery, little secret slavery and other forms of kind of insidious laws to force people who are technically now free to stay where they are and to continue to live basically the life that they had lived as slaves. So this is why Reconstruction had to drag on so much, because too many people in the South refused to accept the idea that their former slaves now could join them as fellow members of society. So they instituted what people have called black codes. So an example of these types of terrible laws were that you had to have a job or you could be arrested. So this was a kind of insidious kind of slavery, because so you were a slave, you had been a slave, and now you're free. But if you don't have a job, then you can be arrested and forced to work. So with that kind of law, you're basically just putting people back into slavery. Because the 13th Amendment says you can punish somebody for a crime and force them to work. So now the black codes were going to do just that, make it a crime to not have a job. So that kind of insidious conduct was why now the federal government had to do its part and say, all right, we have a job to do here. We have these societies in the South that refuse to do their part, that refuse to change, that refuse to adopt these rules of the society that we want. So we're going to have to enforce them. So the federal government created the Freedmen's Bureau. Freedman is just the expression for former slaves, right? A man who is now free, a freedman. So the federal government created a Freedmen's Bureau, and this was a really interesting initiative. So on the one hand, the government would provide food and clothing, you know, basic life necessities for former slaves that were destitute. So I think that was entirely needed, right? Because they've abolished the, in a sense, the kind of the society upon which the slaves depended to a certain extent, not by their choice, of course, but they lived within a certain society and survived because of it. Now they've been torn out of that context, so they need help to take care of themselves. And then the federal government created what I kind of think of as the head right of Reconstruction. So the Freedmen's Bureau would grant 40 acres of abandoned land to any freedman. So kind of reminds me of colonization. It reminds me, and it's a kind of parallel that I like between the initial colonization that was successful for forming the United States, forming the colonies, and now we have this example of kind of giving these former slaves an opportunity to work, because these are hardworking people. They've been enslaved. They know how to do all this work, but they don't have any land to do it on. So now they can do it for themselves. So the Freedmen's Bureau would provide 40 acres of land to a freedman to get his start in life, essentially. So that was a positive step, but people in the South, again, refused to change, resented these provisions, resented the way that their society was being remade, and resisted it. And so following the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau Act, the government had to take further and further steps to protect the freedmen. One of them was the 14th Amendment, 1868. And so what they did was they said, well, we have to explicitly make sure that these people now are recognized as possessing all the same rights as everybody else in America, so we're going to make them citizens. Because at this point, you know, they were in limbo. They were slaves. They weren't Americans. The Dred Scott case said, if you're a slave, you're not an American. So the 14th Amendment overturns that and says, if you're born or naturalized in the United States, then you are a citizen of the United States. And therefore, you are allowed all the protections of the law, equal protection before the law. So this was another crucial step forward in terms of protecting freedmen and saying, we're going to take seriously the idea that we're going to build a society now that's going to have the same protections for everybody in it. The tragedy of this was, again, the cultural response in the South. They refused to accept it. I mean, obviously, some people did and some people didn't, but enough people didn't that it became a crisis. Some former Confederates formed what was called the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK, a secret society to enact violence against freed slaves, to intimidate them, to try to maintain a society in which they were in power as they previously had been. Now they couldn't do it legally, so they would do it illegally. Every time the federal government would impose new restrictions on them, rather than accept those and accommodate themselves to it, they would rebel, find some new way of resisting reintegration into the United States. So in 1870, the federal government had to pass a force act, essentially implementing military rule over the South and attacking the Ku Klux Klan. So it took a while. It was not until, and now that was along with passing the 15th Amendment, which was the last of the Reconstruction Acts, that said, everybody who is a citizen of the United States has the right to vote, and the federal government will protect people's right to vote. So it took a while, and it was not easy, and the Southerners didn't want to do it. But at every stage where they rebelled, the federal government imposed new restrictions on them, new limitations, forced them to accept, used military rule if necessary, use military power to finally force them to accept it. So the southern states eventually all did rejoin the Union, officially become a part of the federal government once again. And in 1877, the military rule of the South was ended. So as far as the past is concerned, that's what happened. But as you can tell from the way things went, the culture of the South retained a great deal of resentment and refused to accept the outcome of the Civil War, and in a great many ways was still rebellious and remains rebellious to this day. So we'll have to revisit this because there were still issues that resurfaced in American history. Sadly, the Ku Klux Klan returned in 1915 and then later on in the 1960s, as some of you are probably aware of, and so on. We have more and more issues pertaining to discrimination and violence against black people, involving racism, of course, in American culture. A lot of difficulties continue to this day. So still very much an important issue. And not an easy thing. It's a scar. And it hasn't quite healed still. I don't know if it ever will. History sometimes is like that. People carry the weight of what has happened. If they don't resolve it properly, they carry the weight of it, and it haunts them for good. I don't know if and when America will get over it. All right. Well, the good news is that at least technically Reconstruction came to an end. The country was put back together again officially. And we are going to do at least some positive stuff. Next week, we're going to talk about the Industrial Revolution. So we're going to talk about the fact that with this done with, and fortunately with the North not especially disrupted by the Civil War, the Industrial Revolution was really kicking up. And a lot of really amazing changes were happening in terms of technology. And pretty soon the United States was going to be the world's greatest industrial power and hence the world's richest country. And eventually, of course, the world's most powerful and most important country. And to a large extent, it has to do with this thing that we're going to look at next week, which is the Industrial Revolution. All right. At least we're done with slavery. Thank goodness. That'll do it for today, folks. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.